This episode is sponsored by a company I've used for well over a decade, and that is 5.11. I wore their uniforms back in Anaheim, California, and have used their products ever since. From their incredibly strong yet light footwear to their cut uniforms for both male and female responders, I found them hands down the best workwear in all the departments that I've worked for. Outside of the fire service, I use their luggage for everything and I travel a lot, and they are also now sponsoring the 7X team as we embark around the world on the Human Performance Project. We have MRF coming up in May, and again, I bought their plate carrier. I ended up buying real ballistic plates rather than the fake weight plates, and that has been my ride or die through MRF the last few years as well. But one area I want to talk about that I haven't in previous sponsorship spots is their brick and mortar element. They were predominantly an online company up till more recently, but now they are approaching 100 stores all over the US. My local store is here in Gainesville, Florida, and I've been multiple times. And the discounts you see online are applied also in the stores. So as I mentioned, 5.11 is offering you 15% off every purchase that you make. But I do want to say, more often than not, they have an even deeper discount, especially around holiday times. But if you use the code SHIELD15, that's S-H-I-E-L-D 1-5, you will get 15% off your order or in the stores every time you make a purchase. And if you want to hear more about 5.11, who they stand for and who works with them, listen to episode 580 of Behind the Shield podcast with 5.11 regional director, Will Ayers. Welcome to the Behind the Shield podcast. As always, my name is James Gearing, and this week it is my absolute honor to welcome on the show former Tier 1 Navy SEAL, current contractor, and the author of American Mercenary, Daniel Corbett. Now, in this conversation, we discuss a host of topics, from his early life, his journey into the military, deploying to Iraq, Somali pirates, his transition into contracting, spending 18 months awaiting trial in Serbia, military transition, seeking discomfort, the aging athlete, and so much more. Now, before we get to this incredible conversation, as I say every week, please just take a moment. Go to whichever app you listen to this on, subscribe to the show, leave feedback, and leave a rating. Every single 5-star rating truly does elevate this podcast, therefore making it easier for others to find. And this is a free library of over 950 episodes now. So all I ask in return is that you help share these incredible men and women's stories so I can get them to every single person on planet Earth who needs to hear them. So with that being said, I introduce to you Daniel Corbett. Enjoy. Well, Daniel, I want to start by saying two things. Firstly, to our mutual friend, Ryan Parrott, thank you for connecting us. And secondly, I want to welcome you onto the Behind the Shield podcast today.
Awesome. Thank you. And thanks, Birdman, for connecting us.
So where on planet Earth are we finding you this afternoon?
You are finding me in North Scottsdale, Arizona.
Beautiful. Well, I would love to start at the very beginning of your story. So tell me where you were born and tell me a little bit about your family dynamic, what your parents did, how many siblings.
I was born in Hawaii on the Army base, or I think it's an Air Force hospital. I'm not sure. Tripler. Anyways, I was born in Hawaii. My dad was in the Army, was a heating, ventilation, and air conditioner, like mechanic guy. Mom and dad met when they were super young. Got married super young, have been together ever since. So, you know, from day one, love was very abundant in the household. Dad, you know, as soon as I was born and at 1 year old, we had left Hawaii. So, you know, I tell people I was born in Hawaii and they're like, oh man, and they start speaking to me pidgin and referencing all these things. And I'm like, bro, I left when I was one. Sorry. They're like, oh, whatever, bro. I'm like, sorry, man. So we left Hawaii, went to Arizona. That's where my brother was born 3 years later. And then from Arizona, we went to Germany. And we stayed there for about 3 years, which is pretty cool. When I was there, it was the time when the Berlin Wall came down. So it was pretty wild taking chartered school buses to school and having, you know, military police with their guns and being briefed on IEDs, like don't pick up boxes or jackets you see on the ground. I was like, okay, whatever. At that age, you don't really know. You just listen. And mom was a full-time, housewife, taking care of me and my brother. My dad would go on 2 week trips or 1 week or 1 month doing, you know, big army stuff. Then after 3 years in Germany, we moved to Texas. I was in Texas for a year. And I think at that time, my dad's rate in the army was going to merge with another rate or something. And it was one of those deals where only 35 or 20% was going to be able to make rank and the rest were going to be kind of capped and left behind. And there was like an incentive-based program where if you just volunteered to get out, you can break your EOS early and they'll give you like 12, 20 grand, whatever. And no harm, no foul. My dad, you know, at that time I was 12, my brother was 8, hadn't seen a whole lot of us. And he's like, you know what? I'm going to take the money. I don't have a plan, but I don't care. And then we left Texas and we moved in with grandma and grandpa, my dad's parents, for about 2 months till I got a job at one of the school districts there doing the air conditioning stuff. And Northern California became home for the rest of my time from sixth grade on.
How was your dad's transition? I mean, obviously, there's an assumption that the people who struggle are the ones that saw combat. But then you look at the statistics, and it's actually not the case. There's a lot of people that were behind the front line that still struggled when they left their tribe that had been a part of for a long time. What was his transition like specifically?
I think he hedged the bets. Hedged his bets pretty good. Like he hedged the situation very well because, you know, he's got two brothers and two sisters and they all lived in the same area. Mom and dad were there. So he had his tribe, right? He had his tribe and he left the military for a big purpose, which was his wife and two kids. So he didn't have that gap of trying to find his new tribe or, you know, having to, you know, seek out friends or anything. It was, boom, it was all right there in his family. And the friends he has now are still the friends he had in high school. Like they're all in the same Northern California area. So he kind of went from one tribe to the military to another tribe, then back to his original tribe when he got out. And I've noticed that too. I see the military is really good, not only with people thinking that that's their tribe, and it is, but people identifying themselves as what they do while they're in the military. Or if you had two brothers the same age and one goes and stocks groceries at a grocery store for 4 years and one joins the military for 4 years, the guy who stocks groceries for 4 years doesn't think his identity is gone when he quits stocking groceries. You know, like, oh, I'm the grocery man. But for some reason, the military, you know, I don't know if it's like genius marketing or what, but we attach ourselves to that job regardless of what it is. Or people on the outside, some do, but most guys are like, no, that's just what I did for work.
Do you think that's because, you know, certainly what you did and partially what I did, they want to break you down? You know, you take an 18-year-old Marine, you know, and the boot camp is designed to kind of make that canvas blank again and then rebuild them. Do you think that's needed, however, also the root cause of why there's more identity crisis in uniform?
I think so. I think also, I was very young when I joined. I'm sure most people are very young when they join. And it just so happens when you find out who you are, you go, you know, I'm this kind of guy. I believe in these things. This is what I like. This is what I don't like. These are my moral, you know, go, no go criteria. That happens at a young man's age, for me at least, was like 22, 23. Like, okay, this is kind of who I am. And then obviously 2 years after that, you look back at yourself and like, you didn't know anything, idiot. You know, and I still to this day do this year by year, right? But that happens around the early 20s, I would say, for young men, and they just happen to be in the military. So they attach it to that also, where the guy stocking groceries doesn't attach himself to that. And it doesn't have that like coming of age experience as to who he really is after high school, after leaving mom and dad. Okay, who am I? Who are my friends? What do I really like? What was I doing just to appease family? What do I really care about? And that happens, and it just so happens to happen when guys are in the military. For the most part, that age demographic fits.
Well, you end up obviously being an incredibly, you know, high-performing tactical athlete when it came to the Navy. When you were in the school age, what were you playing and doing then?
So big-time high school football. Northern California was straight out of Friday Night Lights. That was the way out from my small farm town. It was, we had one guy go to UCLA, some other guys go to some other big schools. And in a way it was max squat, max bench, and run your 40 time and try to make it. And I was getting looked at for a while. And, you know, that was a path where I had to make a decision. Is this going to be my path? But I stopped growing, right? In eighth grade, I was 5'10", 170. I'm 5'10", 170 now. So I kind of stopped, right? But I had the beard and everyone's like, oh, he's going to be a monster. Nope. Everyone caught up and then passed me very, very soon in high school. And I kept getting hurt. I said, man, I don't know if this is it. And then I kind of transitioned to running cross country and doing endurance sports on my own, triathlons and half marathons. Yeah.
I always ask people this because most people have done some sort of individual sport, even though obviously in track you're on a team or cross country you're on a team, but it's you against the voice in your mind ultimately. And yet you've got, you know, football where arguably you can sandbag and the team might still win. You know what I mean? There's not as much pressure on the individual performance. Obviously the goal is to have both. When you look back at the individual sports you played and then the team sports that you played, how did each of those experiences factor into your success in the Navy?
The team sports, obviously the team dynamic, right? A good plan now is better than a perfect plan that's never executed, right? Like knowing all that stuff, managing personalities, you know, knowing when to follow, knowing when to lead, swallowing your pride, not just turning your back to someone who's struggling with something, you know, because you get the whole generic cheesy phrases, you're only as strong as your weakest link, which is true. So seeing all that firsthand and not just in theory, in practical application on the field. So definitely the teamwork dynamics, and then the endurance sports, the individual ones, I call it, you know, going to that place in your mind. And for me, it's a room. Guys that go into BUDS that weren't endurance athletes or never been in that room, never had to go to that place. When you first open that door in your mind and go in that room, it's cold, it's scary. It's a foreign new place. But if you can put yourself in situations where you go into that room often, then you can clean it up a little bit, build a fireplace in there, a rug, a couch. So my room where I need to go in my head when things get tough, I mean, it is decked out. It is super nice because I spend a lot of time in there. And I think those endurance sports, you spend a lot of time in that space in your head. And for me, I picture a room that is now very furnished, very comfortable.
One of the issues I see in my profession is a lot of guys will look back and say, oh, I was in my best shape of my life when I was in the fire academy, you know, and we don't have physical standards. You know, most fire departments do not have a standard that you have to adhere to year in, year out. So the most diligent obviously keep themselves in great shape and they do all the way through to when they retire. The least diligent, you know, breathe a sigh of relief when they leave the fire academy and then every year they have to get new pants because they're getting bigger and bigger. One of the scariest things to me is, if you haven't been in that room and it's still cold and there's still cobwebs in there, and then you get a fire and you've got to climb 10 stories or 20 stories with 100 pounds of gear and then go in and get a kid, you're not going to be able to perform. So to me, it was less about the physicality and more about being in that pain cave. The last time I was in a horrible place in a red, you know, the red line workout was 3 days ago, it was 5 days ago versus 3 or 5 or 10 years ago.
What is your kind of philosophy on that principle as you progress through your career, maintaining that suffering in your training?
I have one leg up, I would say, and most people, I enjoy it. I enjoy seeing where my limits are. I enjoy not only the result, but I enjoy the process. I enjoy the day-to-day to get there. And I have to admit, when I left SEAL training, you know, I wouldn't say I have a problem with authority, but I was so just, it had ruined camping for me. It had ruined the water for me. It had ruined running for me. And I'll admit, I wasn't in the best shape. I'm in way better shape now than I've ever been because I know the importance of it, especially, you know, getting phone calls and doing jobs on a moment's notice. You got to stay ready. It's not about getting ready. The importance of the physical aspect to me, it's not even a conversation. If you have a job that's demanding, like, that is not even a conversation. You should not be buying new pants every year. Like, that is a given because that is so simple and so easy to do. That's just lifestyle and small decisions every day. So to me, the physical stuff, that just needs to happen. Like, don't even show up and talk to me unless that's done. And then let's go with the other stuff. Let's go start making that room in your mind nice and comfortable, nice and furnished, you know. Let's make frequent trips there, you know, 1-3 times a week, right? So you don't kill yourself. But, you know, I like it there. It's fun. It's where everything's quiet. I'm not worried about taxes or my phone going off or emails. It's my own little fortress of solitude.
Now, what about career aspirations when you were going through high school? Obviously, you were considering football. Were there any other kind of prospects that you were thinking back then, or were you already thinking of the military?
I was so young and having such a good time in high school. I mean, I was good with girls. I was a star athlete. And it was great. And I never even thought life existed out of high school. You know, I was just like, oh, this is great. And then one year in cross country, the assistant cross country coach said, hey, what are you doing after? I'm like, after what? After practice? He's like, no, after high school, you idiot. And that's when it clicked. I'm like, oh shit, I have to do something after this. This didn't go on forever. I was like, fuck, I don't know. And I don't come from a family of academic students. Like, oh, you're going to go to Yale like your dad. Like, that was not a thing in my household. He goes, okay. The next day he brings me a VHS tape, History Channel, Navy SEALs. And it showed all the cool training. Talked about the 200-to-1 kill death ratio in Vietnam, said it was the hardest training in the world. And then when they interviewed one of the SEALs, they said, what makes you guys so good? The guy replied, it's not that we're good, it's just that everyone else just sucks. And I was like, okay, that's cool. I like this. I can get down with that. And I was always, you know, pretty intelligent. I was put in some trials, like super smart after school programs. It was fun, it was stimulating, but the people, you know, they're nerds, which is good. I love them, but like, I wasn't trying to go party with them. So I didn't really fit in there. And then I'd go hang out with the football guys, but their focus was like really, really right in front of their face. It was like, let's get drunk and party. I'm good with that too. But there was nothing mentally stimulating outside of that. So I was like, fuck, where do I go? And then when I saw that documentary, it seemed like, okay, these guys are crushing it on the physical side, and they also seem super intelligent. Let's go there. That seems like that's going to cover all the bases for me.
Well, you mentioned already, you know, furnishing this little room in your mind. I've obviously had a lot of people from the SEAL community now and other special forces groups. And I think the big myth that the average person thinks, you know, myself included, until I started doing this, was that, well, it's the uber athletes that get through, you know, Hell Week or Buds or whatever it is. And then you start hearing, and it's not, you know, it's a spectrum of people, and a lot of people are, you know, pointing, oh, that person's definitely going to get through and they don't, or vice versa. So with you specifically, I mean, you said you kind of, you know, physically stopped growing at 170. What was it about your physicality and your mental element that allowed you to progress through the selection process when so many people rang the bell?
I think, well, for one, like you were saying, the run times aren't crazy. Like a high school cross country kid would crush the runs, right? A high school swimmer would crush the runs. So the times, they're not Olympic times. They're hard, but they're not unachievable. And I think I got very lucky the way like a special forces body, 5'10", 170 to 185, like on the obstacle course, you're like that kind of that perfect height, perfect weight. You're not too lanky. You're not too short. So kind of lucky there. And then I think a lot of the guys who quit are guys who never even had a key to that door in their mind or didn't even know that room was in there. And they had to go in there the first time. And it's the first time you go there. It's scary, you know? It's cold. It's dark. Like you said, there's cobwebs. There's roaches across the floor. I'm like, whoa. And I think the guys who've been there, the water polo guys, the wrestlers, the endurance guys, they tap into that every day at wrestling practice. I did wrestling for 1 year, and I was like, holy shit, it's one of the hardest things I ever did. I think the people who have that room built, furnished, comfortable in their mind, they've been there multiple times before they get to Buds, have a way better chance. And the guys who've never gone there, maybe they'll get through. But I haven't seen it.
Now, am I right in understanding that you were assigned to five around the same time that Jocko and Leif and some of those guys were in?
I think I was after them.
Okay. So, because yeah. I know you deployed to Iraq first. So on all these conversations, I know there's a lot of war stories and, you know, there's things certainly that your community can't or won't talk about. So the way I like to approach, you know, the sailor's experience in this case is not so much from the specific, you know, things that you saw and did in war, but more with the human experience. So the first one I always ask, was there a point, regardless of the politics that sent you to wherever you were deployed, that you witnessed atrocities and realized that there were some horrific people that needed to be taken care of?
Oh, yeah. 100%. You know, the politics of why we go to war and, you know, did this guy really have these or whatever, that's way too far removed from me. And I was a very junior guy and it's not even my realm. And I wouldn't even know what to do with the information if I had it all. But yeah, we've seen guys, you know, decapitated, heads in fridges. Yeah.
Now, what about the other side of the coin? I think we because the reason I asked this question, I didn't preface it, I normally do. You know, when we're back home, the civilians, the first responders, everyone else who's not wearing a military uniform, we get a very polarized view of war. It's either let God, you know, kill them all, let God sort them out, or they're all baby killers, you know, depending on which channel you've chosen to turn to. But obviously, the boys and girls, arguably, that we send overseas to fight for our country, you know, they're the ones that we should be asking. So, you know, that one side is obviously, again, like I said, the horrors of war. But the other side, which you also don't hear, is the kindness and compassion that people, you know, witness on the battlefield. So what about moments of that? You know, that we've heard so many stories of military vets taking care of local animals, you know, building schools. I mean, all these things that just don't seem to make the press. What were some of the things you remember as far as kindness and compassion while you wearing the uniform?
Well, first off, we're going into the polarizing of the war, of war itself. I think during World War II, when there's a trench and you have one unit that looks like this and they wear this uniform and then we are on this side, like it's very easy, right? You're bad, we're good. And they're saying, well, no, you're bad, we're good, boom. When you start doing like the whole global war on terrorism and you're not at war with the country, you're at war with groups within the country and they're at war with each other and they're not wearing uniforms. Like it's already hyper nuanced and very gray. So for people to say, oh, you're all bad or you're all good. Now you're getting very binary to the group of people that are in this very nuanced, very gray situation. It doesn't make sense. You need to treat that very nuanced and very gray and give the people that are over there doing it that same lateral movement and wiggle room. As far as the whole compassion stuff, yeah, I've seen guys adopt dogs. I've seen churches, not churches, schools being built. That wasn't my thing. I wasn't there to do that. If I wanted to do that, I would have joined the Peace Corps or something or volunteered at a church. I was there. You know, I didn't go through some sort of animal psychology course in Buds nor any carpentry schools. I went to shoot guns.
So what made you make the decision to challenge yourself yet again and enter DevGuru?
My best friend at the time was screening, and he's like, hey, you want to screen with me? I said, sure. And this was before all the attention, a lot of attention has been put on the SEAL teams. And I think there were some guys senior to me in my team that had previously screened for DevGroup and didn't get picked up. So I kind of knew about it. I really didn't even know about the program or the command. And if I heard anything about it, it was very negative, because I think there were some bitter individuals that were like, fuck that place, blah, blah, blah. So it was never an aspiration of mine, really. And then my buddy told me he was going to try out. He said, I should. I said, what I got to do? He said, you got to go see the Master Chief. Walk in, go see the Master Chief. And he said, hey, I was actually looking for you. I want you to do this. And I was going to ask you. I was like, oh, perfect. So filled out the packet. And then when their staff came over to do the screening on the West Coast, was lined up, ready to go.
And again, same question as before. What was it? Because now you're, you know, a tier one within an already elite team. What was it mentally, physically that allows you to succeed in that selection process?
Same thing. And I tell guys this all the time. I've seen guys, this is after my time at that command, I'll see guys getting ready after they've been selected, they've been picked up, and they go, oh, I'm going to start doing yoga. I'm going to go like vegan. I'm going to go carnivore. I'm like, don't change anything. Don't change anything. They asked you to come because you're doing something right. Don't stop being you. Once you get there, yeah, maybe don't go out till 2 a.m. every morning and eat more for breakfast than a Snickers bar and a Monster. Maybe that's not the best way. But you've been running on that for like 5 years now and crushing it. Now's not the time to change it or try to clean it up. Like, just keep going, hold your course. And then when you get through and you want to perform better or change your lifestyle, do it then. Unless you're doing something super detrimental, okay, yeah, change it as soon as possible. But just stay in the course. They asked you to come for a reason. Why would you change what you've been doing? It doesn't make any sense.
Again, you're talking about organizations that, you know, are secret for a reason. So I'm not even going to address, you know, any of the things that you did. But I think where there's a lot of value to the a comparison is the innovation that I've heard from some of your fellow team members that you're allowed to kind of forge in that position, you know, trying to find the latest training and equipment and those kind of things. Talk to me about that philosophy specifically, because my profession in the fire service, a lot of us are taking classes on using vacation days and paying out of our own pocket just to get better at rope rescue or extrication. So I would argue we're on the other side of this. What I would love to see is my community, ultimately, when we fix a lot of the glaring issues, really embracing that, the innovation. I mean, we still wear pillows for gloves, for example. Our radios still don't even work in half the buildings that we go into. Yet people can go to space. You know what I mean? So there's a big disconnect. Yeah. So what did you see in that community as far as your ability to really, you know, explore the outer areas to find the very, very best techniques, training, and equipment for your men?
That starts day one of BUDS. It's that free thinking outside the box mentality is developed and fostered from day one. Prime example, we're doing night rock portage where we have to do the little IBF on the boats, on the rocks in front of the Hotel Del. It's night, it's winter, big waves. And we're standing there with the boats in our head, and the instructor goes, if you guys can tell me what time it is within 2 minutes, your boat crew is secured. You're done. Okay. The officer of my boat crew says, hey, Corbett, come with me. We run over to where it's all taped off and people are watching. You know, I went with him, swim buddy, 6 foot roll, ran over, saw two people standing there. Hey, what time is it? It's 8:52. Are you sure? Yes, it's 8:52. Roger that. Run back over. Who, yeah, instructor so-and-so? It's 8:52. And he was like, okay. Like, he liked that we did that. He liked that we figured out a way to really figure out this time while maintaining our 6 foot distance to our swim buddy. And like, we did it. you can see the gears turning because I think he wanted us to just shoot in the dark and guess. And we didn't get hammered for doing that. We got praised for it. So it was like, think outside the box. And I think a lot of units are different. I think my dad would bring home the Army booklets. They're really cool sketch. And there was one for everything. For every little thing, there was an instruction manual. How to do this, how to do that. It was cool, but it also showed so much structure that unless you read it and it didn't come from, and it came from this book, you couldn't do something outside of that. And you can't write a little pamphlet for everything you might come across in war. So that mentality all the way through BUDS, and if you get a good SEAL team, you know, they don't, this is how we've always done it, blah, blah, blah. And I didn't get that. I got, hey, what do you think? As a new guy, like, me? I'm like, oh, I think we should come in from the north because of da, 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 da. And they go, huh, it's a good idea. We're going to do that. And you're like, wow, I'm a new guy. And you guys, you're going to take this on board? All right, hey, plan the route. I'm planning the route? Oh, sweet. So my first platoon, before I even got to SEAL Team 6, was all about that. And when you get to SEAL Team 6, even more so. Like, what do you guys think? Here's your target deck. How do you want to hit this? How do you want to do this? How do you want to go about it? So that's where I think a lot of people are confused when guys transition out. They go, oh, you're a rank and file corporate guy. Let's get you a rank and file corporate job. And I go, no, these guys are creative. These guys are artists. We're left brain. Okay. And they're like, wait, what? That doesn't make any sense. But your military guys order, wake up at this time and go to chow at this time. I'm like, some. But in essence, what we do is create solutions to these asymmetrical problems. They're like, oh, that makes sense. So yes, from BUDS all the way through my time at SEAL Team 5 and through selection and even being at the command at SEAL Team 6 was all about, what do you guys think? What do you want to do? What if we did this? Oh, shit, let's try it. It was good. It was great.
What are the mistakes that other organizations are making? So, for example, what I've seen, I've worked for an excellent fire department, Anaheim, California, and the training was extremely high. You know, the culture promoted fitness. You didn't have to have standards because almost all of us were in great shape. And there was a lot of trust. So a lot of the training was run by firefighters, engineers, you know, captains, the lower ranks. Conversely, the last place I worked at, there was zero training, zero standards, and the micromanaging, ego-driven environment was completely toxic. So I got to see kind of both sides. I would argue one of the best departments in the country and one of the worst. The way that you move forward, obviously, is a high level of training. And then, like you said, the trust, allowing these professionals that you've hired that are wearing a badge to do the job that they've been trained to do. Have you been exposed to this other side in responder professions that you've worked alongside? And if so, what would you say to the first responder professions to maybe start fostering the kind of environment that you were trained in?
Yeah. There's things you can control and there's things you can't, right? I can't speak to any other units in detail because I don't really know their training cycle, but I will hear guys be like, oh, I've been to this school. I've been to free fall school. I'm jump qualified from a different branch of the military. I go, oh, cool. They're like, well, I'm the only one and I did it 10 years ago. So not having cyclical training, you know, because in SEAL teams, you check in 6 months, go to schools, come back 6 months, work up, hit every block, boom, 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 and then you deploy. And then when you come back, you do the same thing, right? We have that cyclical training. Now, that might not be possible if there's budget concerns, right? Not everyone's going to get allotted the right budget and time to do that. And then the most critical, obviously, is culture. And that is like the biggest butterfly effect when you graduate BUDS and go to a SEAL team. And even within that team, go to your platoon. If you have a fat, lazy chief who's going through divorce and is just getting drunk every night, you're going to have a shitty culture in that platoon. If you have a chief that's crushing it, fitness, let's fucking work out, let's get more time in the range and pushing that, and it just breeds that culture and it's contagious. And it's contagious on either end. It can either be a cancer or it can be something good. So culture from the top is definitely huge. And I've seen my fair share of leaders get the boot at the SEAL teams for just not being leaders and the men not trusting them.
How do you maintain standards, like through all these different kind of hats that you've worn? Because, I mean, you've got obviously leadership failures, I mean, in this particular example, and or fitness failures. There really is no accountability in my profession. And you, again, hope, and I'm being very, you know, compassionate with this. I talk a lot about the environment that our first responders work in, and it sets them up for failure, hands down. The shifts they work, the mandatory overtime, you're going to get broken, you're going to get fat unless you are uber diligent. But, you know, you listen to not only just your community, the ocean lifeguards, for example. If you can't pass a swim test and do all the things you got to do, then you're not an ocean lifeguard anymore. It's just that simple. How have you, you know, how do you find that, how do you maintain those standards in your communities that maybe the first responder professions can kind of start to learn from?
Well, the easy answer is hard line. I mean, you show up to SEAL Team 6 first day selection and you missed your push-up by one push-up or your run time at 1 second. That's it. So being hardline on the standards, right? No good old boy hookups because, you know, he was ex-Marine and we have a bunch of Marines on our SWAT team, so we'll give him another pass. Or he's a big dude. He doesn't need to pass the run by that much or at all. So being hardline on your standards. And then, like you were saying, I have a buddy who is a police officer in San Diego and – you know, there's a little bit of civil unrest going on, and he was working like 14-hour shifts, and he sits in a car all day with body armor on. And he doesn't have any way to heat food. So, yeah, could he wake up early, hit the gym, meal prep on his one day off? Yeah, he could. But how long can you maintain that with your day-to-day being 14 hours in the car? Like, you know, you're going to break eventually, but, you know what? I'm getting McDonald's. And it happens. So I'm, you know, totally spitballing here, but for those first responder type jobs, incentivize guys. If you have a budget, pay for their gym membership, you know, do something instead of, oh, that's just the way it is. And that's the worst thing. I hate that statement. Oh, that's just the way it is. Or that's the way it's always been. Who cares? Doesn't mean it's right. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. I always say, you know, they stop putting kids up chimneys and then working in factories, you know, because one day they realize this is wrong. You know, it's that simple.
We shouldn't be doing this.
All right. Well, then I know you transitioned to a training role as well, shifting away from my profession more towards the law enforcement side. You talked about the cyclical training, and this is something, you know, the skills that I learned as a firefighter, you know, if I didn't keep practicing them, they just would go, especially ropes and knots. I just, my tiny little brain would just struggle to keep it if I wasn't constantly going over it. What are you seeing as far as the weapons training in the law enforcement side? And again, king for a day, what should be happening to help our men and women in uniform actually perform at the level that they're expected to?
First, you need to fund the police. That's the first thing. Budget creates training opportunities. Training opportunities create skill sets. You know, I've talked to police departments like, yeah, we're allotted like something crazy, like 15 rounds a month or like something, like some stupid number of bullets that are allowed to use training, which is crazy to me because if I miss in Afghanistan, I'm probably going to hit a brick mud or a mud wall somewhere, the open desert or some mountain. If NYPD misses, and they're in Times Square, you know what I mean? There's a lot of people standing around, so I would want my police department guys to be shooting super hard.
Yeah, absolutely. And then from what I've heard, and again, I'm not a cop, but obviously I've got a lot of friends in that profession, worked alongside them for 14 years, but what I hear is even the qualification. A lot of times you're standing there with a static target in a range, firing 6 shots, and then you get a little check mark, and then that's it for 6 months or a year. I did the sheepdog response with Tim Kennedy, and that's, you know, like a 2-day introduction between the combat side and the shooting side. But even that, you're moving and shooting and, you know, shooting from different positions. So what about that element? You know, the training that they are getting at the moment, is it, you know, what should be the gold standard for, you know, an officer with a sidearm and a rifle, as you said, that could be in a densely populated city?
So I teach some shooting out here in Arizona, and I bring an 85-pound kettlebell out with a rope, and you know, I make people get the heart rate up, because if you think as even if you're a trained police officer or someone doing like a home defense situation, if you think it's going to be this static on the range, load your gun, take your breath, line up everything perfect, get your shot. If someone breaks into even my house at 3 a.m., my heart rate's going up. You know, and that's going to affect everything. Your breathing goes up. Your sight picture might move around a little bit. And I think train how you fight. You're never going to have a perpetrator with a gun, you know, 7 yards away from you on an indoor range where you get to load your magazine and he just waits for you to get ready. I think, you know, it's the old adage, train how you fight. So you're not going to fight indoors on a gun range with a static target. Go shoot, move, and communicate. Go get your heart rate up, shoot, move, shoot from behind your car, make radio calls, know what that's like while you're in a gunfight. How do you get on your radio? Like, really do a practical application.
Yeah, there are some amazing videos of people who are doing it right. There's one, I forget where it was now, of one officer that pulls up, and I think he takes one shot with a rifle, but he's, again, so radioing
like 75 it. 75 yards or something, yeah. He pulls out, he's like, boom!
Yeah, exactly. Good. But then you have, you know, just to one that pops in my mind immediately, you have one that was in, I think it was like a CVS or Walgreens, and the officer missed whoever he was trying to hit. It went through a wall and killed someone, you know, within that store, you know. Now, not blaming anyone. I mean, who knows what that environment was like and how difficult that shot would have been. But like you said, there are so many examples of success of well-trained officers. But sadly, on the other side, there are a lot of examples of where either communication or lack of training have resulted in, you know, civilian death. So when you were in the training position, what made you decide to pull the trigger as far as transitioning out of the military specifically? And then let's talk about going into the contracting side.
It'd been a while since I was in the career counselor's office. So I went in and I said, hey, am I up for this big reenlistment? She's like, no, you missed it because you didn't do some paperwork shuffle that you had said you were going to do later, whatever. So I missed a huge signing bonus, and the war had slowly started to get really political. Like, hey, you need to bring, it went from 5 to like 15 partner force guys with you. And then the helo that picks you up is going to drop off a team of investigators from that country and see if everything went down. It was all kosher and you guys are all in the clear. And a lot of guys were like, I don't want any part of this. Like, oh, you know, we need you to do a shooter statement, right? Like, guys were like, we're not doing, no. So between that and missing out on a big paycheck, I said, well, that's it. I'm going to get out. And at that time, I had no plan. So I just got out and reached out to a couple companies and started contracting on the big container ships. Come down through the Suez Canal, stand on the bridge wing, ride that for 20 days, come home.
So how was that? Because you've still gone from an elite, tight-knit group to, you know, outside that group now. Was there any jarring elements of that position?
Yeah, it sucked. I'm thankful for the company for the opportunity, but, you know, some of the guys were like really old. There were some studs on there, but there was like really old guys that couldn't even put their gear together right. And I'm like, what am I doing? And yeah, I'm a Navy SEAL. I've been on the ocean a little bit, but being on bridge wing in the middle of the ocean for like multiple days, I'm like, dude, this is not for me. This is like the most lonely I've ever been in my entire life. It sucked. And I was like, yeah, this isn't it. This is not it.
And what was the threat that they were expecting?
Pirates.
Okay. Yeah. Was that Somali specifically or from other Asian areas too?
You would hit a certain parallel. I forget what it was. You'd catch the boats on the south end of the Suez Canal, take a little boat, climb up a big ship, get settled in. And once we got past a certain parallel, I forget which one, we would stand watch and, you know, go hit all the ports, come back through, and that was it.
Obviously, you know, SEAL Team 6 is known for specific rescue when it comes to Somali pirates, but it's been interesting hearing certain guests talk about the origin story. And again, this isn't like apples to apples specifically, but I had no idea that the Somali coast was being overfished by a lot of other countries, and that was creating a lot of poverty in that nation. Did you ever get exposed to that, or you know, did you see another side to simply the Hollywood, or not the Hollywood, even that one event specifically, which was a hostage situation that had to be mitigated? Did you ever see the bigger picture with that nation specifically?
No, I mean, that was a container ship. It wasn't fishing. They were doing a ransom job, right?
Yeah. But I mean, of the whole kind of piracy in general, was there a broader perspective?
Yeah, does poverty breed crime? Sure. Just don't fuck with Americans, I guess, right? I mean,
absolutely. All right. Well, then with that, you're on ship. So where did that take you next?
Did that for a little bit. And then I had to swallow some pride because I'd seen so many guys leave the Navy and they're like, oh, I'm going to go to Wharton. I'm going to, you know, get my MBA. I'm going to do this and do that. And I saw a lot of guys come back, you know, 6 months, a year later. And I'm like, man, if I could, I'm never doing that. I'm never coming back. I'm going to go blaze my own path. Did that contracting job for about 6 out of months, and I was like, man, I'm really missing the teams, missing my purpose. So I called up the reserve SEAL team on the West Coast, SEAL Team 17. I said, hey, what's up, guys? What do you think? Come on over. So I went to the reserve SEAL teams and mobilized early so I can get on orders, which means you have a paycheck. Did a quick workup and deployed to Korea for 6 months, which was awesome. Came back and kept trying to go to schools because in reserves, you kind of have to hustle and get yourself into schools and figure out which pots of money you can use for schools so you're not taking all the SEAL Team 17's money, and find schools that the big Navy will pay for so you can go to that school. So I was just doing that hustle, staying on orders, getting paid, learning new schools.
How was Korea? I've had this conversation quite a lot recently. I was just recently flying home to England a few weeks ago, and I saw a documentary about people who escaped North Korea, and it showed some who actually were successful and some who were arrested and then sent to the gulag. I mean, it was horrendous, but it illustrated how close Korea came to be completely overrun, and how, you know, the allied nations that came from the US and other countries literally saved South Korea and then help drive everyone back north. And it's a shame that that generation gets such little discussion when it talks about their service. What was the perspective that you got in the 6 months that you were there at the time that you were there?
Korea is like a city from the future when you first get there. And I think it's because when we landed there, it was nighttime and we went straight to a bullet train. And it was all the neon lights. And I was like, oh my God, this is crazy. I felt like I was in like a sci-fi show. It was pretty cool. I think a lot of the good that people did, and you know, some of the older generations were like, hey, you guys are awesome. We remember what you guys did. Because the Korean War wasn't that long ago. But I think with the longstanding military bases there, you know, there's something happens out in town or there's a car accident, I think those started to overshadow, you know, all the good we did a while ago during the war. But all in all, my experience was great. I worked with the South Korean SEALs, and I was always curious if other cultures, special forces, was like a thing. Was it like a vibe? Was it a scene? Was it like, oh, that guy's a this? Oh, that. And in Korea, very much so. They're like, oh, you're UDT? Yeah, UDT is good. And I'm like, oh, sweet, awesome. So like it was cool to see their country have pride in them being UDT, the UDT SEAL, and the SEALs being very, very prideful in, you know, their job. So it was cool to see that they had their own culture that was like super honorable, a lot of respect. So that was fun.
Beautiful. Well, walk me through then to Serbia, and let's talk about that entire kind of mental health nightmare that you endured.
Yeah, so I was doing some other contracting, and I was on a very light job, if any job, in Serbia. Wrong place, wrong time. I'm at a house. I get arrested. And, you know, from that moment, it was just absurdity, chaos, confusion. It was bananas. So I get arrested at this house, the kid's house I was staying at, comes in. He had left for the evening after he got a phone call. I don't speak Serbian at the time, so I have no idea what he was doing. 45 minutes later, he comes flying in his house, handcuffed, slams into the wall. And I'm like, what is going on? And I look over to my left, and there's a 9mm pointed right at my temple. And I'm like, what the fuck? And I kind of focus at the person. And it looks like a police uniform, but it looks like it was bought at Party City. It looked so shitty and cheap. I was like, what? And then I hear the magazine springs rattle. And then I kind of focus up, and it's this like 21-year-old kid with a pistol at my head, with his finger on the trigger, terrified so much that I can hear the gun rattling. And I was like, dude, like after all I've been through, I hope this isn't how I go. So I'm getting yelled at in Serbian, and I just do, you know, I thought this would be an international move, regardless of language. I just slowly put my hands up. I'm like, this, I think this is the move to do. Got cuffed. You know, long story short, we were going to have a party at this kid's house. He got arrested trying to buy drugs from a drug dealer, and drug dealers have guns. So there was gun, drugs. The drug dealer had a friend, and the kid's house I was at was there. So those three got arrested in, well, I forget the name of the city. They took the kid back to his house where I was. And like, you're an American. I said, yes. You like guns? I'm like, as much as the next guy. Like, what's going on? And all right, this is weird. You're going to jail. We go to the police station for three or four days, and I'm interrogated, and they're like, what do you do? I'm like, oh, I'm a defense contractor. What qualifies you to do that? I'm an ex-SEAL. Oh, and you're in Serbia, huh? So, like, they just ran with it, and they're like, you're here to kill our president. I said, who? They said his name first, and I'm like, I don't know what that is. Oh, it's our president. I'm like, no, I'm not. I don't know what the fuck you're talking about. You know, and then, you know, getting interrogated, and I spoke pretty good Russian at the time, and the English translator did not know any English. And I shot in the dark. I said, maybe it's better we speak in Russian if you guys know Russian. And they just was like, he's a spy. He speaks Russian. Like, they just lost their minds. So during the interrogation process, there was a good cop that understood. He goes, look, dude, I believe you. I get it. But I need you to know that this is already to the newspapers, and you're famous. I'm like, really? So we go to the courthouse. We make initial statements. The judge is like, yeah, I don't know what's going on. You're going to jail. Okay. So I go to jail. Wait for 3 months. Go to make an official statement again at the small court. They're like, yeah, you're good to go. Cool. Come back. The guard's like, come on. I'm like, all right. Start packing my stuff. He's like, no, go back to visit your lawyer in the meeting rooms. The lawyer says, hey, man, after you left, the judge got a call, said you had to be charged with something. So buckle up. It's going to be a long time. Because there's four of you in the case, and four people in Serbia is organized crime. So now they're looking at this as an organized crime. I'm like, what? Yeah, in my first room I was put in, I was in there with a guy who murdered his wife with a hammer, a guy who's a professional kidnapper ransom guy, and then some kid from Croatia who's a terrorist. And because I was in that room, we only had 30 days outside our room for a walk, and it was just us. And you know, they're like popping pills, and you know, the prison was giving pills to anybody who would take them. And I'm like, I'm good. And they'd stay up all night, and he'd play his little radio. And one day, you know, after a couple nights of no sleep, I just took his radio and bounced it off the ground, shattered. And the next day I was transferred out of that room. Thank goodness. So I finally got to a room. We had an Aussie cocaine dealer who got busted doing a big deal. A junkie and a state-sponsored killer. So it was good. There was order. It was clean. And I got to go 2 hours a day outside my room, not just 30 minutes. And it was with the whole block. And it just, you know, first I didn't really have to like tap into my room too much. Cause I'm like, okay, they're going to tell that after April, after the 3 months I was there. And then they said, hey, you're going to be charged with something. That's when I needed to get comfortable in the room I've created in my mind. Right. That's when I had to really dig in and, okay, what can I do today that's in my control? I can work out. I can make flashcards from my Russian-Serbian dictionary. And I can play chess. I can get good at chess. Like, these are things I can control. The rest, I can't worry about because I can't do anything about it. Yeah, it sucks. But there's no point in me focusing any energy on the things I can't control. So I just, day to day, like, what can I do today to be better at Sudoku, chess? Make 26 flashcards instead of 25 I did yesterday. Do one more push-up. Do one more burpee. And that went on until, I think, June or July. And then a big lawyer had decided to take on my case. And the following week, he was assassinated in the street. So they came in my room. You know, lift the junk, spread the cheeks. Fuck. What? Ripping everything apart. And they thought I had something to do with it. And the front page in Serbian, picture of the crime scene, superimposed photo of me, lawyer killed because of Seal. Boom. Just, and then the newspaper, just the hit pieces kept rolling in. Boom, boom. Every time I was up for house arrest, because everyone else in my case had house arrest. Every time I was up for house arrest, even though there was no progress in my case at all, there'd be a hit piece the day before a judge was going to assign house arrest or not. It would come out in the newspaper. Like, very coincidental timing, right? Very, very nice for them. Finally, after 11 months, I was charged. And during that time, you know, I took, you know, not only working on the tangible skills like learning Serbian or getting better at chess or working out, you know, you have a lot of time in silence to yourself. Like, no phone, barely any TV. You know, I was learning Serbian, so I wasn't able to have a whole lot of engagement with people, right? And you would start to have these thoughts. You'd have to have memories. And some of them were bad. Like, God, I can't believe I did that. I hope that person doesn't hate me. Right? So I say, okay, let's dive into this. So every night I'd lay in bed for about 2 hours and just do a deep dive from my earliest memories of everything I've ever done that wronged somebody. And, you know, and it was hard because, you know, in my head, I would ask them for forgiveness, but at the same time, you know, that's up to them to forgive me. But for me to move forward and focus on my day-to-day mental health, I had to forgive myself for the things I've done that wrong people. So I did that for like 10 months straight, just everything I could even think of that I did that was bad or wrong or hurt somebody, I'd go do a little audit, forgive myself, and move on. And I had to be really mindful to think about the good things I've done too, right? Because it's very easy to focus on the negative. So I did like a little soul cleansing every night while I was in Serbian prison.
You mentioned the Aussie drug dealer. His name wasn't James Gearing, was it?
His name was, there was three of them. I think he might, Christian Waters was one of them. And David? Fuck, I'll look it up.
Yeah, that was funny. Just the reason I ask, when I first started this, if you Google my name, an Australian coke dealer came up called James Gearing and a pedophile from Manchester. So luckily now if you Google it, luckily it's all the podcast stuff and they're all buried down there somewhere. But that's why I asked. It would be kind of funny if my namesake was one of your prison mates.
Yeah. I looked up my name way before any of this, and there was one guy who's a weatherman in the UK. So that's all I have. I don't have any drug dealers.
Man. Well, back to, you know, your incarceration during this time, what was being done or tried to be done from the U.S. side?
Zero. State Department came in, U.S. Embassy, and he seemed so terrified to even be in there. And he would ask me questions like, hey, how's the food? And I'm like, dude, it's bad. Can you change it? Oh, no. I'm like, why are you asking me these questions? What are you doing? Oh, okay. Oh, yeah. I'm like, look, man, I think they're going to charge me with something since it's bullshit. And he said, well, you know, maybe plea deal's not a bad idea. There was a pedophile in Indonesia, and they gave him a plea deal, and he didn't take it. Now he has a bunch of years. So why are you telling me about some pedophile in Indonesia? What are you talking about? Well, I'm just saying, and they just crumbled. And even the guards were like, dude, the embassy's here. Like, you're free. This is stupid. I'm like, yeah, awesome. The cavalry's here. USA, Uncle Sam, let's go. And they're like, well, you know, I don't know what they're saying in the news. And I'm like, what? The tabloids? And he would always come in with a Serbian national who worked in the U.S. Embassy. So they were a team. And she was like, I get it. This is BS. I'm sorry. This is happening to you. But the American guy was like, oh, I don't know. And he was useless. Guys like, oh, why didn't you sign any papers to let the military or someone help? Because the people handing me papers were those people, and I didn't trust them. I did not trust him at all. I signed a thing, yes, you can tell my mom and dad about what's going on. But any other papers, I didn't trust them as far as I could throw them. So I wasn't going to sign anything for that guy. Which is so funny, because when you go to SEER school, survive, evade, resist, escape, you're taught like, once the Red Cross comes or the U.S. Embassy comes, like, that's good news. Like, you can really lean into them. So, boom, U.S. Embassy comes, and it was not good news. So now I'm in totally uncharted waters. Like, what do I do? And I pretty much told them to get lost, and I'll figure it out.
I had a wrongfully convicted 18-year-old at the time on the show, Greg. And very long story, very short. He was a star football player. His parent or his mother had got sick, so they kind of moved closer to where the hospital was. So he'd actually stayed with a teammate, a football teammate. There was an outcry because the family had a daycare and a little kid had said that Greg had touched me. A complete abandonment of any proper investigation. He ends up getting put in prison for this crime. So you can imagine how he was received in this prison by the fellow, you know, prisoners. Ultimately is proven completely innocent, and they figured out that the friend that he stayed with was actually the pedo that not only did that but also raped someone while Greg was in prison. The biggest thing though that was hard for him was just not getting into trouble while he was in prison, because, you know, that would just, you know, add to the sentence you already had. Now you're in Serbia, you've got some pretty dangerous people around you. How are you able to not rock the boat? I'm assuming that you were probably being, you know, preyed upon by certain people while you were there.
Surprisingly, it was not the case. I mean, I had one incident, but it was like staged, and it was a, I'll go into that. But the newspaper said I was there to kill the president. The newspaper beat me to the prison by 4 days. Everyone in Serbian prison, inmates, guards alike, hate the Serbian president. So when I showed up, guys were saluting me and were like, yeah. And I was like, what's going on? And I came to find out that's why. And plus, that country is very homogeneous. So there wasn't a whole lot of diversity that people could stand behind and try to argue over, which, you know, not that people should. Like, oh, I'm this color, you're that color, you're this religion, I'm that religion. It's all pretty much the same in that country. So there wasn't any of that, like, as far as violence goes. There was a couple, there was one guy got killed, two guys got killed, but it's kind of an us versus them mentality. Us is everyone in jail and them is the system, right? So even the two cocaine mafias that are big in that area, there's two guys in there and it's kind of like, you be easy, I be easy, let's get out of here. And if we need to do stuff while we're back in the streets, let's go handle it there. Because everyone's trying to get out. And where I was like a holding prison for guys in court. So no one wants to go to court and say you're an innocent good boy after you cut someone's neck with a tuna can and bled them out in the courtyard. You know what I mean? So everyone's trying to keep it pretty chill.
So what changed? You didn't have a lot of support from the State Department. Obviously, you're getting, you know, constant highs and lows as far as the expectations are being released. What was that kind of light at the end of the tunnel in the end?
Then I got charged. We finally had charged because legally they have to charge me in 6 months. Well, they didn't charge me for 11 months. I mean, there's rules, and then if they're applied and adhered to is one thing. So that was the big victory, being charged after 11 months for possession of a firearm, possession of a firearm and explosives, and something else, I forget. Okay, cool. And then another month later, we got a judge. And it took a month to get a judge because no judge wanted my case. Because they looked, they said there's no evidence against the guy. And the Minister of Defense was saying, oh, he was here in their newspaper. He wasn't here to shoot fish in the Danube River with that pistol. Well, I didn't have a pistol, right? So now there's this external pressure from the government to see something happen to me. And, you know, the judge, with the oath they took to uphold justice, is like, there's nothing here. So we finally got a judge. And in January, a year after I was arrested, was my first court date. And in Serbia, there's no jury. There's just one person to judge. And the way the court system is so backed up there that the way it works is you go in, opening statements. That's it. You just do your opening statements. And then you come back 30 days later to do the next part. And then 30 days later for that part. 30 days later for that part. So trial took 6 months.
I don't know how you remember what people were saying. There's a 30-day gap between every presentation.
It was so disorganized. And I think once or twice. I think once. It was like court date 3 or 2. And now I have like cool things to look for. A year, you have nothing. I had nothing to look forward to. It was just an ambiguous time with no event to look forward to, just sitting. And now I have 30 days. Okay, opening statements. Okay, examination. So my second court date, you know, get in the paddy wagon. Obviously, I get my own paddy wagon because I'm dangerous and I'm like Hannibal Lecter and I have MP5s on me. It was completely out of control. Show up, sit down, judge gavels in, words, 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 judge gavels out. My lawyer's like, yep, see you in a month. I said, what's going on? Like, your interpreter didn't show up.
Oh, God.
Okay. I said, you speak better English than anyone who's ever interpreted for me during this whole process. Like, I can't, I'm not a court certified. Oh man, so that day was probably like the biggest bummer because that set you back another month. Like, shit. So yeah, that's how the court. So I stood trial. I stood trial in Serbian court for 6 months.
So how were you released ultimately? What was the final verdict?
So the day of the verdict, I had the worst translator I ever had. Judge has the other three guys stand up, reads them their sentence, whatever, and then me. And then towards the end, my interpreter's like, you can go. I said, yeah, but under what circumstances? Because I was sure they were going to say, guilty, time served. Right, you can go, and like we appease our people that you're guilty, and you can go home. She's like, no, you can go. Like, but like, what is she saying? She said, you're innocent. Okay, good. And the judge looks at me. She goes, hey, if we find you innocent of all charges, I'm sorry this happened to you. Hope this doesn't put a bad taste in Serbia for you. You're going to be compensated for all legal fees, mispay, damages. And I was like, okay. Go back to jail, grab my shit. Then I had to go to the customs office because my visa had expired. And I was like, look, man, I don't think the days I was in jail should go against it. That's BS. And I was getting really argumentative because it's been there for 18 months. I don't care. I was just acquitted. And these guys are interrogating me again. I'm like, no. Their superior comes in. He's like, how does 7 days sound? I said, that's good. I mean, regardless, I was gone in 2 days anyways. But I was feeling a little bit argumentative at the time.
Understandably so.
Yeah. So yeah, I stood trial and was acquitted.
So what was that homecoming like? You've been sitting in a a Serbian jail for 18 months, you know, again, still separated from your purpose and your tribe and all the things. What was that return for you?
It wasn't as big as one would think, because my mind was never in jail, right? Like, I was never mentally in prison. And I always, you know, my family's so strong in love, my friends are so strong in love, and I could just feel it. And I always carry that with me every day in prison. So when I saw mom, dad, and brother waiting for me at the airport, it was just like another day for me. I don't know. It wasn't that big. My biggest surprise was coming through customs, and they were just like, yeah, welcome back. Like, there was no, like, what were you doing there? I was like, okay, cool. It was good to see everyone. Mom and dad were very relieved, as well as brother, but it wasn't anything too crazy. You know, I was in the SEAL teams. I deployed. I'd write on the back of my warrior's paper or the embassy people's paper during our visits, like, mom, watch the movie Idiocracy. Don't worry. That's what's happening right now. Don't talk to anyone. I love you guys. Don't worry about anything. So there was like one-way communication going out to mom and dad. And it was like a long, shitty deployment, I guess, right?
So you come back. What made you decide to put pen and paper and write American Mercenary?
Well, I come back, and then 30 days later, I go take another job. So I go fly to another country. I get a call saying, hey, do you want to write a book? And I said, nope, because I was still chasing the dragon of doing the job I was doing. You know, I was like, oh, how could you go back and do that after what happened? I'm like, well, cowboy doesn't quit writing if it gets fucked off, right? You learn and you get better and you keep going. I'm like, okay, but that's a little different than going to prison for 18 months. Like, yeah, potato, potato. So I get the call. I say no, because I want to keep chasing this dragon. And the dragon is now turning into a fine mist very, very, very far away. And the writing on the wall is just not there anymore. Get a call again. It's like, hey, man, I think this would be a really good story, really good book. I said, well, I don't want to do a SEAL book. I don't want to just do, I was in Buds, I ran, there was a log, it was water, it was cold. I don't want to. It's like, no, that's fine. All that stuff's been talked about, like your story and what you did after and the Serbia stuff, your mentality. And I said, okay, I can get behind that. Yeah, so that's how that got started.
Well, I know we had a brief chat before we hit record. You're very passionate about that transition. And I think this is something that I see jarring in the first responder professions. As we touched on, you know, you have tribe, you have purpose, you have, you know, this ingrained community, the shared suffering. And then a lot of us, whether it's promoting to a chief's desk in a building somewhere else, or whether it's retirement or an injury or being fired, you know, now that person finds themselves alone. And in our profession, there's no VA, there's no, you know, medical anything. They just literally, the door closes behind you and that's it. Your ID doesn't work anymore. So talk to me about that kind of principle through your eyes and the message that you want to convey to people listening.
Just because one tribe was your tribe at one point doesn't mean you have to be monogamous to them, right? I have friends I play indoor soccer with, or used to before I ruptured my Achilles, and you know, They play Dungeons and Dragons, right? Like, they're not SEALs, but we enjoy soccer together. To branch out and not be so married to the concept that it has to be your tank battalion or it has to be your SEAL buddies, because, like, they're not even SEALs anymore, neither are you. And you live in Colorado and he lives in Texas, right? So be a little bit brave, branch out, try new things, and explore, because you'll find something. Yeah, I don't think anyone's that one-dimensional, like, I only like guns. Like, really, dude, you only like guns? Really? There's nothing else you'd like, right?
What about the employment side? What I've seen in the fire service is a lot of men and women will transition out and then they'll teach at a fire academy. In law enforcement, it seems to be the security work that people go to. But as you touched on earlier with, you know, a member of the teams, it's not about fast roping and, you know, using a weapon. It's the teamwork and the problem solving and the, you know, the ability to work under fatigue and suffering and all these other areas. And I find a lot of our, you know, professions in uniform feel so myopic when they leave, and they're not really made fully aware of the skill set that we have and the application in a thousand different ways, and it could be used.
I think that goes into what I was saying earlier too, like, I'm a cop because when I was this age and I did it for so long, I had that moment where I realized who I was and now I'm this. I challenge people to ask themselves when they're 16, 17, 15, 12, what else did you like? Go explore that. Right? You don't have to be in this realm of things. You don't have to stay there. Is it safe? Yes. I did it. Boom. Contract. Quick money. Right? But don't sell yourself short. You're not that one dimensional.
Absolutely. All right. Well, I want to go to some quick closing questions before I let you go.
Yeah.
The first one I love to ask, we've talked about your book. Are there any other books that you love to recommend? It can be related to our discussion today or completely unrelated.
And Thus Spoke Zarathustra by Nietzsche. Ender's Game. Meditations, obviously. And anything Dumas.
Dumas.
So fun.
Brilliant. All right. What about films and documentaries? Are any of those that you love?
Snatch.
It's a good film.
So good. Films, documentaries. I kind of been jumping on that true crime bus, man. Whenever true crime, I'm on. I like, when the History Channel, like World War II in color and all that, like that's killer. Films? Oh, man, I've been watching so many movies. God, I had just too many lists. Snatch is my all-time favorite.
Brilliant. All right, well, the next question then, is there a person that you'd recommend to come on this podcast as a guest to speak to the first responders, military, and associated professions of the world?
Have you had Jeff Nichols on?
I have, yeah. Yeah, Jeff's been on several times.
He's like, when you say that, I'm like, boom, that's instantly to him. Oh, man. I might have to get back to you on that one.
Yeah, no problem at all. I need to get Jeff back on again. It's been a little while now. I think I had him and Catherine last time.
He's so smart and he has the science to back it up and he's so practical.
Yeah, yeah. And he takes the gloves off too. I like the way he talks.
Oh, yeah. He doesn't hold back. Yeah.
All right. Well, then the very last question before we make sure everyone knows where to find you and the book. What do you do to decompress?
Man, I work out. I run. And I think I have mitigations in place. I'm more preventative. I don't ever really get compressed. So I kind of live my life to not be compressed. So I don't really have to, I need to decompress. I need 2 hours after X, Y, or Z. I'll go for a nice 10-minute pace, nice long run, clear my head, have a good playlist. Yeah.
What about, you're not old, but what about as you've watched yourself age as a tactical athlete, how has your training and rest and recovery changed as you've progressed through this career, if at all?
Yeah, well, October 31st, or late October, I ruptured my Achilles playing football, soccer. So that was an eye-opener. My buddy was a pro baseball player. He's like, nope. He's retired now. He's like, 37? That's it. That's all you have. I quit playing pickleball and tennis because of it. Like, I can feel it. So, just because my mind wants to keep going, my body is now starting to, my Achilles rupturing was more than just a subtle hint. My body's screaming at me like, hey, cool, awesome. You have the great mentality. Beautiful. But we have 40 years on us, so relax. So I will still try to do things. Like when I was running recently after my, it's been 7 months, I can't kick as hard and get my heart rate up at pace. So I'm like, okay, what can I do? I'll throw on a hoodie and it's 110. So like I can do, I'm still trying to get to my room and, add some paintings on the wall in that room in my mind. It's got to get creative and maybe not go as hard.
What I found, I'm just turned 50 and I had this realization that I'm not ever going to be as fit and strong as I was when I was younger. Now I'm, in great shape for 50 for the path that I want to be on, but the focus has gone to addressing all the things that I did to my body as a firefighter, as a stuntman, as a, martial artist. And by addressing some of those injuries, that's given me more fitness, more strength. So not chasing the kind of, 25-year-old goal anymore and giving yourself some grace, but realizing that you'll actually be an exceptional athlete at the age that you're at if you actually take it down one notch and focus on damage mitigation rather than PRing that bench press that you were chasing, you know, 20 years ago.
I think my two goals now are maintenance, just maintaining what I have now, and not having to ever buy clothes the next size up. That's it. Like, if I get to accomplish that, I'm good. I can still do as many pull-ups as I like to do or run X amount of miles at the right pace and still fit my clothes. That, to me, is my new definition of success, 40 years and plus.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. All right. Well, then for people listening, where can they find the book American Mercenary? And then where else can they find you on the web or social media?
American Mercenary is available pre-order through Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Books A Million, I think Target, Walmart. If you go to the Hachette Book Group landing page, it'll give you the drop-down, all the options. And you can find me at American_Mercenary on Instagram. And if you go on that page, there is a link to that landing page I talked about for the publishing company with all the drop downs to, you know, purchase a book if you want or what type or from who. So @American_Mercenary on Instagram.
Beautiful. Well, Daniel, I want to say thank you so much. I mean, there's certain people that come on the show that, you know, you're not going to dive into specificities of what they did because it's classified and it's none of our business. But there are some really powerful parallels that I think that we've been able to discuss today. So I want to thank you so, so much for being so generous with your time and coming on the Behind the Shield podcast.
Yay. Awesome. Thanks for having me. Let me know when you want me back. I'll be more than happy.